noted our curriculum as set forth in our outline of academic program, you will note that one of the subjects which we have considered important is the philosophy of history. And so this evening we will present the first of a series of discussions bearing upon this subject. And as it seems that history is a rather sterile subject, as generally considered, we would like to do something, if possible, to point up its importance from the standpoint of its effect upon our daily living and daily thinking. First of all, what is history? The word is broadly used in two meanings. History is basically events, actual occurrences, factual happenings. The second meaning of the word is the record of such events. Now, there's a great difference between these two meanings, although this may not at first seem especially relevant. The fact of happenings we cannot deny, but the records of these happenings are not always as authentic or complete as we might desire. What are the principal handicaps that face the modern student of history? Let us go back to perhaps the most challenging part of the historical perspective, and that is origins. All origins relating to our cultures and our societies are obscured by a mystery which we call the dark curtain of history. We can go back a certain distance, and beyond that point, we fall into uncertainties. Perhaps the greatest basic reason for these uncertainties is the inadequacy of ancient recording. Up to a period which we will describe later, man had no systematic way of preserving the records of his experiences. And this immediately gives us another interesting sidelight. Ancient history did not depend primarily upon the importance of events, but upon the nature of the materials upon which the records were kept. Thus, a vital and important incident recorded on a perishable medium may disappear, and did. Whereas a less important event upon a more enduring medium, preserved upon stone, or cut into marble, or cast into bronze, may have continued for our admiration. So the first hazard of history was writing materials. The second hazard was that histories must be written, to a measure at least, by contemporaries, in order that later historians may draw upon source material. This material must have existed. And in each generation and each century, man determined, in the light of contemporary emphasis, that which was important and that which required or justified perpetuation. Thus, as we go backward in our historical research, we observe only certain episodes or incidents clearly preserved for us. For such reasons as this, ancient records relate primarily to religion and history. History in the sense of dynasties, rulers, princes, and powerful persons who profoundly influenced the psychological attitudes of their contemporaries. likewise also it was the king and the priest who had available the materials, the means for the perpetuation of accounts. It follows from this that the royal records and the ecclesiastical records are the oldest and the best preserved. Even in these, however, there are differences and difficulties. The fall of dynasties, particularly in Egypt, resulted in the obliteration of previous records. And the decline of faiths often caused old records to be destroyed by new cults wishing to remove all record of their predecessor. Thus we have vandalism as well as the natural circumstances of time gravitating against the preservation of history. We also realize that when histories are written by a limited group of persons, particularly privileged or prejudiced persons, we cannot depend entirely upon their validity. In the Greek period, one scholar stood very firmly and said, "The non-factual historian is a traitor to the ages." And this is true, essentially. Because if we receive biased accounts of previous occurrences, the important philosophical contribution of history is damaged. History today is approached more or less psychologically. We are not so much interested in the events which at one time dominated public attention. We are interested in the relationships between events. We are interested in penetrating the sequences of causes and effects. We want to understand why it came about that certain insignificant minority groups rose to power and world position. We also want to know the machinery which toppled great empires into oblivion. We want to understand the operation of cause and effect as this is recorded in historical annals. Thus we come to what has been termed the morality of history. The evidence that history is a broad justification of the great ethical and moral institutions which men have cherished from time immemorial. We like to believe that from the contemplation of history, we may gain useful instruction for the conduct of our own affairs. This brings us to the next, perhaps, most valid consideration. Where does history begin in relation to the focal point of ourselves? Man is surrounded constantly with occurrences. Those immediately occurring, those things which happen from day to day, we record or like to think of as news. News is what is happening. History is what has happened. The moment an incident ceases to become or ceases to be news, it becomes history. History must therefore not be limited to national, racial, cultural motions. History can be applied to any subject in which a dynamic of sequences can be recognized. As one historian has said, everything that lives is historical. And there are many things which do not have a life in themselves about which history can also be gathered. We can write the history of a Ford car and the development of the automotive industry. We can write the history of motion pictures. If present conditions continue, we may also write its obituary, apparently. we can write the history of a cell in the human body. Therefore, history reaches into biology, into physics, into chemistry, into mathematics, into atomics. For everything which has a continuance has a history. These records, we know today, must be accurate in order for them to be useful in the advancement of man's knowledge. During the 16th and 17th centuries, histories of strange things are included. Lord Bacon, for example, wrote a work entitled The Natural History of Winds, in which he collected various material bearing upon air currents, storms, and other astrophysical phenomena, on the assumption that the gathering of all forms of statistical information constituted a form of history. The hot summer of 52, the cold winter of 49, the depression of 29, all these facts are valuable if we know what to do with them. As we go along, we are inclined, therefore, to accept historical record without too much question. And in this way, we've made numerous and profound mistakes. Up to comparatively recent times, there have been few impartial historians. For many hundreds of years, histories were written by victors at the expense of the vanquished. The loser was always badly treated in history, regardless of the causes or values involved. Also, history has been mutilated with innumerable prejudices and false accounts, and it has also been unable to penetrate in all cases the veil of deceit which surrounded an incident or a happening. Thus, persons have been wrongly accused. False credits have been given. Proper applause has been withheld. Blame and censure have been misplaced. These things in themselves are unfortunate, but perhaps we can say not too significant when all persons involved are long deceased. The real significance lies in this philosophical descent of history, in which every error becomes a weak point in a chain of logic or in a chain of research, and may cause us to come to faulty conclusions about processes or attitudes which we should hold today. It is useless to say that the individual can escape history. History is a psychological force in the life of every person. Even among so-called illiterate savage groups, oral tradition, which is their form of history, has a vital effect upon the survival of customs, beliefs, fears, hates, affections, regards, friendships, jealousies, and feuds. Perhaps the most desperately detrimental factor in European civilization has been its perpetuation of international, interracial, interreligious feuds, which have become the dead causes of continuing living disaster. Thus, history becomes vital to us. And until the 20th century, or certainly the 19th, very little effort was made to record the history of peoples. The so-called private citizen was forgotten by history. Into the limbo of blessed forgetfulness have flowed the careers of countless hundreds of millions of living persons. Yet these careers have not been totally and completely sterile. Some of the greatest achievements which we have today would have been impossible had it not been for the activities of persons not recorded at our time. Thus, we have to fall back upon the collectives. We have to realize that almost all major changes in the destinies of collective groups have been the result of the activities of individuals. It has been estimated that in a generation such as ours today, the weight of the world's security and its advancement rests in the keeping of not more than 10,000 living persons. All the rest are dependent upon this small group in some way. It may be that it was only a sentence that someone uttered that would cause millions of others to move. But that one person, remembered or forgotten, who sparked the change or incited the motion, is still the guiding and dominant spirit. Thus, history is actually also the record of man's acceptances and rejections of various policies, attitudes, pronouncements, convictions stated long ago by individuals, in turn perpetuated first by small groups. We know, for example, that it would be impossible today to estimate the effect of the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth. One man preaching on the Sea of Galilee has changed the course of billions of human lives. We may say the same in Asia, that it is almost impossible to estimate the effects of the teachings of Gautama Buddha. These effects continue. It is not likely that during his lifetime, Plato ever had more than 200 or 250 followers. Probably less. It is doubtful if the dialogues of Plato existed in more than 20 copies at the time of his death. And yet there is no political structure or social institution known to the civilized world today that has not been affected. These things have unfolded and continued, increasing in a strange and mysterious manner. What does this tell us from an historical perspective? It tells us that ideas are all subject to the censorship of history. By this we mean that they must pass through time, and in their descent through time, they are applied by a variety of individuals to a variety of purposes. If these applications fail, or the ends are inconsistent with the needs, the material or idea is rapidly lost. It disintegrates. It disappears. Now, you might say that none of these older records actually disappear. They do in the course of time, but perhaps time again must be more carefully analyzed. The British Museum at the present time contains probably 14 million volumes. It is the greatest accumulation of books in the world. Of these almost innumerable, inconceivable volumes, there are thousands, probably hundreds of thousands, which will not be touched, opened, or read in the next 1,000 years. The persons who wrote them exercised prodigious influences at certain times. But these influences have not survived the changes of history.
and have lost all vitality for us today. I can think of one early group of sermons by a prominent divine who was greatly honored in his own day and was an outstanding exponent of hellfire and damnation. In this generation, he is not only seldom read, but his name is not even generally known, and there seems to be no reason to stir up a situation by mentioning it at this time. It is far happier that he be allowed to rest in the desuetude of limbo. Thus, persons great, prominent, or important in their own day disappear from our remembrance, and others, almost forgotten, are suddenly revived or brought back to our attention because we have suddenly learned to appreciate or recognize some value, or have come into some situation which they anticipated, or have sensed in them a prophetic mood about the shape of things which now concern us. Thus, history is a sieve, constantly sifting out and separating the living and the dead. Living not in the sense of bodily existence, but living in the sense of idea. Dying not of body, but dying of idea, which is no longer valid or no longer important to us. Thus, history tells us an important lesson. It tells us, for example, that there is nothing changeless but change. It tells us that life as we know it is a continuous, dynamic unfolding of potential. That everything that exists grows, and everything that has being obeys the discovery of Galileo. It moves. It has within it motion. And history is a record of qualitative motion, as well as the descent of families or of states or of nations. As we go back over history, therefore, we are reminded not only of the episodes which it preserves, but of the silences which it also keeps. We are aware of the tyrannies of the past. We observe man's inhumanity to man. We observe also, in broad moral and ethical terms, that history is a long record of the victory of good over evil, the victory of progress over decadence, the victory of life over death, the victory of motion over static, the victory of dynamic over impotence in all fields and departments of existence. History is also the optimistic reminder that in the midst of days when everything seems to be going wrong, that history is the record of a slow but inevitable growth. And history is also a reminder that growth cannot be without interludes of decline, but also that life and death, growth and decay, progress and deterioration, these forces operate simultaneously. And the descent of every culture has had contemporary ascent of other cultures. The falling of a nation corresponds in time to the birth of a nation. And while each individual in history has departed, the great vital motions of human experience and activity go on unbroken. So history is the story of the victorious survival, the eternal resurrection of life from death, of the new from the old, of light from darkness, a reminder that every night must end in dawn, just as surely as every day must end in night. And as history is the valid account of an eternal restoration, a continuing resurrection, as insistent and inevitable as the seasons which follow themselves in nature, so we can understand why ancient peoples, in their allegories and symbols, associated the story of history with the great cycle of the phoenix. Now, this brings to us perhaps a key to one of the most interesting and remarkable fables of the past. A fable which factually and actually we cannot fully explain today, simply because of the imperfections of history. But enough has descended to us to be able to restore, in part at least, the broad pattern of this symbolical concept. Ancient peoples, including the Greeks, the Egyptians, the Persians, the Hindus, and the Chinese, and a little later, the Japanese, all shared the belief in the existence of a strange and fabulous bird called the phoenix. In the ancient belief, particularly in the Mesopotamian and North African areas, only one of these birds lived at a time. The Chinese said that there were a pair. But the cycle of the phoenix was the life of this bird. And this bird, when it died, first built a nest of flame, in which its body was consumed. And as it died, its body burst open, and the newborn phoenix came forth. Therefore, it was born of fire and of death, and as such was represented in ancient symbolism, usually as a bird similar to an eagle, surrounded by flames, with wings spread, as though soaring upward to the sun. The phoenix to the Egyptians and most other ancient peoples was a symbol of immortality, but it was also the symbol of a time cycle. Herodotus and many others have left us records of the phoenix. Cicero mentions it, so does Seneca. And in the story of China, we have it preserved for us in a strange bird resembling a crested pheasant. It comes to us also as the Quetzal bird of Central America, of the Aztec and Mayan cultures, and it is the thunderbird of the North American Indians and the Totem Indians of the Northwest. This bird was a symbol of priesthood, because in ancient times, the logographi, or the keepers of the words, historians, were priests. When the time came to devise a symbol for the great seal of the United States, the original design was a phoenix, because it was definitely an emblem of restoration, of regeneration, of resurrection, of the attainment of freedom, and of the victory of life over death, of light over darkness, and of wisdom over ignorance. Many cycles were attributed to the phoenix. Some of them have a fair relation to the great sequences of the equinoctial motions, others to the great metonic cycle of the moon. But perhaps the most interesting and mysterious cycle of the phoenix is not directly associated with any of our known astronomical cycles. For in Egypt, it was frequently said that the life of the phoenix was 600 years, and at the end of every 600 years, it flew into the desert, built its flaming altar, and there died, and that it was then reborn, and that therefore every 600 years there was a vital rebirth of history, a vital resurrection within the life of man, a restoration of the great social institutions which constitute the foundations of human experience. This is an intriguing thought. And while obviously a great deal of necessary information to fill in this story cannot be found, can no longer be differentiated, because even in some of our best histories, events are not placed within 1,000 years, particularly after about 3500 B.C., or rather before 3500 B.C., still we can do considerably in attempting to clarify the possibility of the Phoenix cycle. Before we go into this, however, there is a philosophy involved, which I think we should also consider. History tells us that every motion, every institutionalized procedure of human experience contains within itself two factors, two intimately associated elements. One is the vitality by means of which it shall live, and the other is the defect by which it must inevitably die. Therefore, everything that lives has the cause of its own death within itself. Every institution endures because of its strength and perishes because of its weakness. Thus, strength and weakness must exist together. And wherever institution exists, the corruption of that institution is almost inevitable. In fact, we have never been able to produce a system within which the essence or substance of its own ultimate deterioration does not exist, any more than we can possess or develop a human body in which the cause of its own ultimate decease is not present. One famous physicist and biologist observed some years ago that man begins to die the day he is born. Races begin to die the day they are born. Everything that comes into this world by that very circumstance is subject to dissolution. Therefore, the only possible cause for death is birth. And that which is born can never escape the processes of crystallization by means of which its organism will ultimately be rendered uninhabitable. Historically speaking, therefore, nations, empires, cultures, teachings, doctrines, all have cycles of existence. And the ancients divided these into various sequences, using a basic unit of 600 years when applied to a social problem or to a political entity, as we may use the ancient biblical unit of 70 years and 10 in measuring human life. We are changing that cycle somewhat, but still we have a life expectancy, which has become the basis of most calculations around which we build the theory of our personal survival and economy. Therefore, in multiples of 600 years, certain elements or factors have been distinguished. And even though nations may survive, peoples may continue, races may be strong enough to outlive a 600-year boundary. Within these groups, there are periodic changes by means of which the original directions or circumstances are altered. Therefore, it is rare indeed to find a philosophy that is not amended, a religion which has not been reformed, a nation, the government of which has not changed, or a cultural perspective which has not been modified in some way after a period of approximately 600 years. Or let us say at least that great and critical conditions have arisen in both the collective experience of total mankind and the more individual experience of racial and cultural groups, by means of which 600-year markers can be rather clearly indicated. In almost every instance that we can conceive, a reformation is actually a kind of resurrection. The purpose of a reformation is to bring something from darkness into light. In this way, correcting a serious error, restating the direction of a purpose, rescuing ideas from the crystallization of institution or organization, breaking away from decadence to preserve progress, or in more recent times, the rededication of institution to the service of individual. This being the outstanding motive behind social existence as it is today. Now, we've mentioned that it's pretty difficult to go back into the early periods of human life and find historic records which give us clear perspective. Such records, as we will find, as already noted, will most likely be of a political or a religious nature in the early periods. The only other type of record that we may find will be an important mass motion of peoples, like a migration. Such records will also often be punctuated by a distinct change in religious perspective, the rise of a moral code, or the redirecting of a spiritual destiny for that people, a revelation, the advent of a Messiah, the emergence of a great modifying change. As we go further back, we must sometimes go through centuries in which we have no record except legendary. And we must accept that mythology can be, and often is, prehistoric history. That due to inadequate records, the relationships of events have been lost. But sometimes, even in the corruption of history, psychological relationships have been preserved by mythological incidents, as in the fables of gods and heroes, and in the fabulous accounts of the foundations of peoples. For in most instances, even today, in the search for the origins of ancient cultured groups, we have nothing but mythological material with which to work. Myth must therefore be regarded as psychologized history. It must be regarded as man's attempt to validate the laws of cause and effect involved in the emergence of his own destiny from a prehistoric veil or from an unknown historical background. Taking, however, a chronological sequence, I noted down and jotted a few things which perhaps will have a bearing upon our 600-year cycle. Now, these are not taken from a work in which this cycle was of the slightest significance. It's just one of those plain, old-fashioned, prosaic histories in which, however, the author attempted a valid and careful arrangement of his dates and facts. Part of this material is taken from Major General Furlong's Rivers of Life, and it will show you certain points which I wish to make. In this particular work, he places the date 3600 B.C. as that of the rise of the great Egyptian ritual, which we call today the Book of the Dead. He says that at that time, forces and persons unknown, because we know no name at that period of any individual, with the possible exception of a few pharaohs, who were not the motivating factors, that at this time there arose among the Egyptians the great conviction of the immortality of man and the belief in a relationship, a moral relationship between conduct and spiritual destiny. In other words, at that time, the Egyptian took upon himself the full impact of the great funeral text or mortuary inscription beliefs that a good life, well lived, ensured the future state of the soul. This, therefore, would be a very great mark, because we know that such a belief did not exist at that time in the Grecian states, and we have no evidence even of its existence in Asia. No historical evidence. We have mythological report, which may be true. But General Furlong points out this date as a fairly certain one upon which to base one of the most important spiritual convictions, which were later, one of the convictions which were later to profoundly influence the entire record of human life. Dropping, in this case, down toward the Christian era, from 3600, 600 years, to about 3000 B.C., and let us see what was happening at about that time that might have some bearing on us. According to the Hindus, this date corresponds approximately with the beginning of the Kali Yuga. Now, the Kali Yuga, or the Black Age, was to the Hindu the beginning of the great karmic age of retribution, which was to continue for 432,000 years. And we are now enjoying ourselves in about the 5,000th year of the Kali Yuga. And the Hindu, describing in his ancient sacred books the conditions of the Kali Yuga, says that during this great period, men shall remember and observe certain things. First, that every man who has an elephant shall be called a Raja. Substitute Cadillac for elephant, and I think you get the idea. In other words, every man who is rich is a prince. The second thing that will mark the era is that man shall depart from the law and during the Kali Yuga shall develop great systems of philosophy or science which deny the existence of God. That was written 2000 B.C. The third point in connection with the Kali Yuga, which was of great interest to the people of that time in attempting to predict the shape of things to come, was that during this great day of darkness, or this great era, the family and the home would collapse, and individuals would place their own satisfaction above common good on every level. We're doing all right with the Kali Yuga, but we are not too happy over it. Now, it is interesting that this date should correspond in the Egyptian chronicle with the date of the death of Osiris. Now, obviously, the death of Osiris is a mythological date. Therefore, we are quite propositively in the presence of an overlapping testimony of cycles. The death of Osiris is described in the Egyptian rituals as the end of the Golden Age, or the end of the Age of the Gods, differentiating between the divine kings and the human kings ruling the world. This date would correspond very closely with the concept, therefore, of the Kali Yuga. Kali meaning black, of course, and Yuga meaning age. This date further corresponds with the Greek mythological record of the Battle of the Titans, in which the gods were driven from the earth by giants, and the kingdom of heaven was overthrown, or at least was forced to retire from the active participation in the estate of man. This date then also corresponds with the ancient date of the founding of the oracles, which were to take the places of the direct contact between the divinities and humanity. And the beginning of the oracles would also correspond in the ancient Hindu doctrine with the beginning of the great age of the rishis, or the heaven-sent teachers, who were to link man and the gods. So in all these different cultures, the year 3000 B.C. is either historically or mythologically related to an incident which may be regarded as the end of a divine era or an age of ancient things. Now, continuing on our descent, we come to the year 2400 B.C., and for reasons which he does not give, the great German Orientalist, Professor Max Müller, says that the year 2400 is the year which dates the keynote of universal religion. This is interesting that these dates should fall in these patterns. Müller believed that at that time he was able to trace the rise of a common spiritual conviction extending throughout ancient cultures and binding them together and establishing the foundation for the later interchange of philosophy, science, religion, art, and culture. But prior to this time, the isolations of beliefs were so complete that the possibility of a common foundation did not exist. Therefore, Müller says that at this time was to be placed the greatest single unfoldment of human hope toward a better time that marked the early period of history. This, I think, is well worth our attention. Continuing downward toward the Christian era, we then come to the year 1800 B.C. which, according to the Hindu record, marks the end of the period of the Vedas, or what is called the Great Vedic Era, and the rise of what was known in Asia as the Mantric period. Now, the Mantric period was that which marked the transition between law and intercession in religion. In other words, it was the beginning of the rise of the ethical religious concept in Asia as we know it. This does not mean that the earlier peoples had no ethics, but it does mean that at this time the ethical emphasis became to dominate religion, and religion began to separate itself from a legistic code, the eye for an eye and the tooth for a tooth concept, and began to move toward the forgiveness of sin and the doing good to those who injure us. It was a great period of truth and love rising victorious over strength and law. It was the victory of love over law, not the dissolution of law, but the reinterpretation of law, so that the strength of God and the power of God began to be deeply considered as the love of God. And deity became not only the great celestial king, but began to take on the aspects of the divine father, or the paternal principle in relationship to the affairs of mankind. This period also corresponds fairly closely with the Jewish Exodus and the rise of another group of important culture factors, the rise of a powerful monotheistic teaching in both Egypt and the Near East, a redefinition of deity, and greater emphasis upon the worship of deity, as this related to the continuance of the life and happiness of the individual. In other words, personal worship taking the place of state ceremonialism as a form of religious observance. The year 1200 in Asia, 1200 BC, dates the birth of Rama, the great avatar of Vishnu, and is the great cycle or period of the Ramayana, or the great classical work, which was also a powerful landmark not only in Asia but in other parts of the world. The Ramayana introduces us to a new concept of human relationships. It is the beginning of the glorification and deification of the natural relationships of human beings. In the Ramayana, the faithful husband and the faithful wife emerge as performing the ritual of faithfulness. That affection for one's brother, common regard for other human beings, emerges as part of the basic ritual of religion. So we see great and peculiar steps moving downward. This period also coincides with the period of the compilation of the oldest 14 books of the Old Testament, the beginning of the rise of religious literature as we know it today. Well, prior to that time, a work such as the Bible, or any collection of essentially religious works, was comparatively unknown. Prior to that, most of the so-called sacred writings were in the form of epics, relating to the origin and histories of peoples, but not emphasizing a class of spiritual writings set apart as scriptural or constituting holy text. The next period, then, after that, comes to 600 B.C., and it is there that we wish to pause for the rest of the evening, because that's where we have to do our work tonight. This has been well called and pointed out to us as the era of the ancient teachers. Sometimes we wonder at the extraordinary circumstance that so many of the most important leaders and important motions in the development of our religious, historical, philosophical, and scientific life were contemporary at that time. Not only were they so contemporary, but there were tremendous changes in the political map of the world. There were great changes within the structure of peoples. There was the rise, for example, of the democracy of the Greek states. There were great and important reformations in Egypt. There were profound changes in the philosophies and sciences of India and China. It was a period of great motions, motions that were to endure, most of them unchanged, for 600 years. They then continued to endure, but there was not one of these motions that did not pass through a marked reformation 600 years later. So we can begin to consider this era of the ancient teachers. And we know that alive at one time, or very nearly at one time, some facts are a little difficult to historically date, but we can say this: within 100 years, there flourished Confucius and Lao Tzu in China, Buddha in India, the last of the Zoroasters in Persia, Pythagoras in Greece, and several lesser luminaries, including the so-called great sophistic school of the Greeks, and the rise of several minor sects in India and China. Thus we have living together a number of the greatest thinkers that we know, who were also living at the time when the great integration of the Old Testament was at its height. For we know that the Old Testament, or the Septuagint version, as we know it today, was in the process of compilation, and that most of the books of the Old Testament that we now have were either revised completely or brought into powerful new organization between the 5th and 6th centuries B.C. This whole period fits together and results in the emergence of a group led almost immediately by Socrates and continuing on with pressure and force throughout the civilized world. We have no proof that these men met, although we have certain possibilities. We have reason to believe from the ancient Chinese annals that Confucius, as a young man, did meet Lao Tzu as the older teacher. The tradition, I would say, has reached a degree of being semi-historical. It is rather strongly supported, and there seems no reason to consider it incredible. There is also a definite tradition among the Greeks that Pythagoras did study with the last of the Zoroasters. This, however, is open to some question for the reason that the term may have been applied to a priesthood rather than to a person. as the Zoroastrians or Zarathustras. It may have been a term to cover the fire priests of Persia. We are not absolutely sure. It is conceivable that Pythagoras, having visited India, may have come in contact with Buddha, or at least met some of his disciples.